Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Join Justin Townsend and the Harvesting Nature crew as they explore the world of cooking wild fish and game while sharing recipes, tips, tricks, and lessons learned from their pursuit of wild food. We sure hope you ate before the show, because you're going to leave hungry. This is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Harvesting Nature's Wild Fishing Game Podcast. You got your host here, Justin Townsend, and today we're doing a field chat. So both Ben and I have been hunting together for the past 5 days, 6 days? Yeah. And up in the mountains in central Colorado for archery elk. And we're going to tell you a little bit about kind of elk season as a whole for both of us. And also really happy to announce that this is our 100th episode, so you're hearing this. If you go back in time, you can listen to 99 other episodes of the Wild Fishing Game Podcast. So kind of a big monumental moment, and what better way to break it in than with a nice discussion on elk hunting, and our own experiences over the past few days elk hunting. So without further ado, I guess I'll kick it off. One thing I will say is that make sure that you're checking out our awesome cooking classes that have been going on. We've been doing those once a week. You can go down to the show notes and click Wild Game Cooking. Those are all virtual through the Harvesting Nature Supper Club. That's what we coined it. And actually, ironically enough, the logo is a cowboy riding an elk, swinging a frying pan in the air, much like a lasso, but it's a frying pan. So it fits very much into this episode, Elk Make the Plan. But let's go ahead and kick off the discussion. So I will let Ben tell you, remind you of who he is and what he does, because it's been a while. So over to you, Ben.
Hey, sorry. Hey, told me I couldn't do that. We've made it a minute, but, hey, I'm Ben. I'm the managing editor at Harvesting Nature. I've also been out elk hunting for most of the month of September, first in Oregon, and then I did 10 days in Colorado. Finished out the season here, and here we are.
Nice. So I think kind of to kick it off, like, I'll talk a little bit about my prior experience. So I have almost zero experience hunting elk. Actually, I have zero experience hunting elk. Before this period, I think I'd seen elk in the wild for the first time last year, heard them in the wild last year, and then up until like our actual elk hunt, had seen them on this cool ranch out in East Notcore Ranch. I saw it was a cool experience as I drove down this dirt road to go antelope hunting, and I looked over and it's a herd of like 100 elk in this high fence farm. But that was kind of neat. First time I'd been up close to elk. I think that video is floating around somewhere on our Instagram page. If not, it will be soon. And then I think prior to that, like, I've had my hands on elk meat several times that people have gifted me, and I've used and cooked some great recipes with it. But other than that, I've never harvested it myself. So this was kind of a big opportunity to, one, both get back into archery season, and then to also hunt elk in Colorado for the first time. Being this is my first year out here, I thought it was a really cool opportunity to do that.
Yeah, so this is my second season doing archery elk. I just moved out to Oregon from upstate New York last year, right about last August. So last season, yeah, it was my first season ever doing it. Pretty steep learning curve. It was challenging, really challenging last year. I felt like, I was like learning so much and trying to figure out where they were and then trying to figure out where to hunt them, because there's a ton of public land in Oregon compared to New York State. But yeah, ultimately ended up getting into some elk in eastern Oregon in a unit that after this year, unfortunately, has gone to draw. But yeah, I did have some awesome encounters last year, which in which I learned a ton about elk and calling. Had probably two that were sub 80 yards and kind of had the very typical elk calling scenario where they just kind of planted themselves in an area where they'd either see me, smell me, or whatever, and just wouldn't come in any further. But yeah, pretty awesome. And then I've been out all over Oregon since the 26th of August. I was out about 16 days. Yeah, all over.
You've been out so long.
Yeah, I've been out for a while.
When was the last time that you slept in your own bed?
Like for 2 days, like 16 or 17 days ago. And before that was like 5 or 6 days. So yeah, I've spent a lot of time out this season. It's kind of archery elk hunting very rapidly became the coolest thing I've ever done, I feel like, in the outdoors, and something I really, really got pretty obsessed with. So I took the whole month off from my company and just pretty much hunted. But yeah.
So how did you approach it? Now, are we looking... So, I know, obviously, what I did, like, over-the-counter tag, but are you putting for draws? Are you doing over-the-counter? Like, what was your thought kind of going into the year with that?
Well, so, I mean, to be honest, the first year, I've really only been living in a western state and thinking about all this stuff for, like, a year. So, I kind of had said, when I moved out, I'm going to just do over-the-counter stuff for the first year, kind of, figure out what is going on first, because every state is so different, and then kind of come up with a plan and figure out where and when I'm going to apply to which area, which state, and all that. But, for this year and last year, I just did over-the-counter tags.
Over-the-counter tags in Colorado.
There's a bunch of units.
Yeah, there's a bunch of units, so...
West of
I-25. Yeah, so you have I-25 basically being the division point in Colorado. To the east of I-25 is considered the plains. Those are their own tags that are basically over-the-counter. Pretty easy to get. Very, 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 very low chance of getting an elk in that area. Like, there's only one zone or one unit that I've seen people harvest from. Over on the other side, the western side of I-25, you have you know, the whole entire state's divided into units. So, but you have units that are draw only due to quota, and then you have units that are over the counter that are basically you can just purchase a tag. In combination with that, they have some units also have cow tags. What Ben and I had were either sex archery tags. They have archery tags for cows, as I just mentioned, and then some have associated archery bear tags that you have to have an over-the-counter tag or a tag from that unit in order to get a bear tag. So they're kind of like, they're definitely combined. And the season runs the exact same period for bear archery. Outside of that, then you have your rifle seasons later in the year, your first, second, third. Some units still being draw, some units being over the counter. Like, it just kind of really got to get into the weeds and look at a lot of information to figure out what you want to do. But I think that's also like kind of one of the issues that we ran into is that we had the over counter tags, and I forget how many zones it is in particular, but we just had this big broad area of like half the state that we were trying to figure out where we wanted to go.
Yeah. So. Yeah, same thing in Oregon. Like I was kind of saying, like when I moved out from New York, you know, where the whole main issue that I had and a lot of people have is like finding any land to hunt. And then public land, which I've had some success in New York and Pennsylvania area. There's a lot more of it in Pennsylvania, but in New York, it's spare and it's a war zone, you know. And so coming out west where it's like, you know, okay, I have literally half of the state of Oregon to try to figure out where to hunt is like overwhelming. So, I mean, should we talk about like how I picked anything, or what do you want to talk?
Yeah, sure, we can do that. Yeah, I think that goes into the scouting and e-scouting portion of it.
Yeah. So, I mean, in Oregon, I just did like the units that were closest to me first. Some of the units were not only over-the-counter for archery elk, but either sex. So I started there last year in the Coast Range and got my butt kicked. Steep terrain, really hard to find elk. They're really educated, and you know, they just kind of ghost you as soon as the season starts, as soon as they start getting pressured. I think a lot of them live in areas that are almost impossible for humans to get into, if not impossible to get into without alerting them, for sure. And that's why they're in there. And that's kind of, you know, I really just started what was close to home and expanded out from there. Last year, you know, I had no luck at all on the west side of Oregon. The state's pretty split up as far as like biomes go. The west side is, you know, the coastal rainforest kind of stuff, and then the Cascades or the high peaks in the middle, and there's not many elk there, although some people really love hunting it. And then eastern Oregon, there's a chunk by the Blue Mountains out in like you know, northeastern side. Got confused. Right? Where there's a high concentration of elk, and I really, you know, it was kind of funny last year because I e-scouted a good amount, quickly found out probably 98% of it was totally useless as soon as I got places.
Like, wait, 98% of what, you're e-scouting?
The e-scouting.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it was either too thick, or there's no access, or there's too much access. That's kind of the deal in western Oregon.
Or there are not trails where they said there were trails, which if you recall, go back earlier this year in May, June period, and queue up our Oregon bear.
Yeah.
We talk a lot about the environment and the climate and the trails and lack thereof, or like proposed trails, and no fault to Onyx or any of the other, online mapping places. I think that it falls more on, it's just over time the way those roads and logging roads and trails and stuff were mapped out, like,
yeah, some of them grew. Haven't, you know. So basically the deal, and we talked about this with the bear hunting stuff in western Oregon, is there's too much access via roads, and then there's, it's really challenging to get into places. So it's not like other places I've been where you can just walk in the woods. Pretty much, if there's no trail, if there's no old logging road or a game trail, it's really, really challenging to walk. Almost impossible and pretty dangerous, honestly, because, you know, it's just so thick and it's so easy to get turned around. But, yeah, so that was most of my last year.
That's episode 327, Oregon Black Bear Boondoggle, if you want to go back to that one. But yeah. Yeah.
And then fire season is a big thing during archery elk. Mm-hmm. This year wasn't as bad in Oregon. We had some really, really big fires that closed down a few national forests. Some are still closed, but they just happen to not be where I was going. In the west side, there weren't as many fires as there were last year. But, yeah, so, I mean, I basically ended up last year, a lot of the west side closed due to fires, extreme fire danger, and I just picked a unit on the map in eastern Oregon and went there, and within my first day was into elk. Having never had seen elk, having never had been there, and I literally picked the first access in this, you know, 2 million acre national forest, and got into elk the first day, and I spent 10 days out there and kind of really cut my teeth with elk hunting out there, which was a super cool experience. But it was kind of like one of these things that goes to show, you know, you can do, I did a ton of e-scouting that was all for nothing, and then I just picked one. Picked mm-hmm. one and went there, and there happened to be elk there, and there were a lot of people that were going in pretty deep, and they were pretty close to the roads. Like, a lot of the good encounters I had last year were, you know, 3 miles, 2 miles from a road. Like, two of the really good areas I was in, I mean, as a crow flies, was probably a mile and a half from the road. So pretty cool experience. And
And yeah. I would say this, like, loops back around to kind of what we mentioned earlier, is like the vastness of that, and not to rule out e-scouting, because I think once you decide on an area and, you know, having like local contact, I think Ben going into it sort of new to the state, new to the area, maybe not with a lot of like local intel, just like you said, picking a unit. I think one thing we kind of did this year in Colorado was once we picked a unit, we all kind of like e-scouted it pretty thorough. Mm-hmm. And we actually bounced around to like 4 or 5 different units.
Yeah.
But we all like, we got on the internet and did some research and, you know, looked in both like Facebook groups, looked at, was it Go Hunt, like a bunch of different places where they talked about the units, and just kind of read through, you know, some of the BS that's out there, but then also like you can pull little useful nuggets out of it, and then combine that with sort of your e-scouting. I think what you recommended, Elk 101, like the courses.
Yeah, that was a great course. There's a lot of good, there's like almost too many resources now.
Yeah.
There's so much, like, and not to discredit e-scouting at all. It's definitely, definitely super useful.
Yep.
You know, and, but it, I think at some point, you know, you just gotta like go,
yeah.
You just gotta get boots to the ground and just get into a unit, and hopefully that's before the season and you can kind of figure mm-hmm. stuff out. But, as soon as they start getting pressured, they start moving all over the place. So
yep.
it's kind of like, yep. get a good idea, you know, look for the typical stuff that everybody talks about, you know, a few miles away from a road, difficult to access, the north facing slopes, steep drainages that have like, you know, the cool dark timber during the day, that are, you know, challenging to get into.
Water,
yeah, food, you know.
And then yeah. we talked about scouting, and you and I have conversed about it since then, and just like, I didn't get the opportunity to go out and scout some of the places that we planned on going to in Colorado, but I also wasn't that worried about it because the elk, too, will move up and down in elevation depending on kind of the time of year, and you've got them moving around during the rut and all the other things that are happening. So I didn't really lean heavily because, you know, I could go out 2, 3, 4 weeks before the season and go scout, and then once it actually comes time for us to get out and hunt, the elk may be in a completely different spot. So.
Yeah. Yeah, especially, I mean, we did the last week of the season. I was out the last 10 days of the season, so I think technically the first day I got there was the last day of muzzleloader.
Yeah.
You know, so obviously not as long range as a rifle, but I mean, as soon as you start shooting at these things, they're gonna be moving all over the place and pretty much just end up hanging out where they're not harassed. Overall,
and we'll kind of get into it a little bit later, but like, yeah, we even saw their movement with hunter pressure from where we were here in Colorado, and saw them shift in elevation and shift over like, you know, 3 or 4 miles in a matter of like
maybe a couple hours. Yeah. Some of them, yeah, and you could hear, yeah. I guess we'll talk about that.
Yep,
later.
We'll talk about it a bit. But let's. I think I want to talk a little bit about kind of getting into this whole idea of season prep. So we talked about scouting. We talked about e-scouting a little bit. I want to hit on physical fitness, because I think, like, you know, it's obviously going to vary where you're at, what elevation you're at. But I think that it is important to note that a certain level of physical fitness is required. I mean, and what we were doing, absolutely, because we were up and down in elevation and up at 10,000 feet and all, you know, hiking around like madmen that we are. But, you know, there's also the other side of the spectrum too, where guys are rolling into their camp and just chilling and doing all that, which I think is great too. Both sides of it, you know, I'm always one to encourage people to get out and do a little extra physical activity in order to prepare for pack outs and hunting season and stuff like that. So just trying to take care of yourself and staying good. But is there anything in particular, Ben, that you were doing preseason to get sort of ready?
Well, I'm lucky or unlucky enough to own a moving company, which is, you know, pretty much the perfect prep for backcountry hunting. You know, I'm doing lots of stairs, I'm doing lots, you know, with a load, carrying stuff, and just going up and down all day. You know, I still lift weights in addition to that, and just try to stay strong and in good shape.
Strong.
You know, and like, I know even in the whitetail world, I've heard plenty of dudes that are like, I got a spot, it's 50 yards from the truck,
yeah,
shoot a huge deer there every year, and there's elk hunters to do the same thing, and God bless you. If I find a spot that's 100 yards from the road and I shoot an elk every year, I will definitely be doing that. But I also think that it's really, really useful to be able to go where a lot of people can't. And, you know, especially when they're in heavily pressured over-the-counter units, there's plenty of spots where it's like, you know, even with some people that we talked to on the trail that were like, yeah, we're not going to go there.
Yeah.
It's too far. It's too high. It's just too much. And, you know, I overall, the most action I had all season was in this area that was, you know, about 10 and a half, 11 miles deep. And, you know, so, yeah, I think staying in good shape is super important.
What do you think about it, too, outside of the fact of just being able to pack in, pack out, and kind of like move up and down in elevation? Think about that, like elevation sickness and things like that, because at the early part of the season, especially this year, we were hearing a lot of people are like, yeah, the elk are above 10,000 feet. Like, to get up there and sort of get acclimated, that takes a little bit of effort. Like, people still get elevation sickness. And, you know,
yeah,
I live here in Denver, and I'm at like 5,000 feet. Ben's in Oregon. I don't know how high.
I'm like, barely, it's above sea level.
Yeah,
but I've been at elevation a lot, and
so
I kind of know what to expect with my body and stuff.
Yeah, and I think that's one of those things that, you know, for some it may take a day or two, for some it may be perfectly normal. We were talking, you were telling me about one of the guys who just hunts tons and tons and tons of elk, just went up this year and just like got really bad elevation sickness.
Yeah, yeah, that's Bo Martonic. Really like his podcast, East Meets West. But yeah, he talked about how he's hunted at altitude plenty of times, and he was like a little sick before he came out to Colorado, and he got super sick, and he's got one of these watches that gives like your blood oxygen, and I think it was, I'm sure someone will correct or whatever, but I think like a normal amount is like 95, anything below 90 is like something's up, and he woke up in the middle of the night and his was at like 70 something. He couldn't figure out how to use his jet boil to make food, and he ended up in the emergency room. So it's like, it's, And in that same podcast, they talk about how all summer they trained. You know, this was like they were training super hard, waking up at four before work. You know, keeping each other accountable, and it still can just totally catch up to you. And you know, I don't know how you could do it totally cold and just like not train at all. Especially if you've never been in elevation and just go do it. I mean, I personally could never do that. It would be, I mean, it kicks my butt every year.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of moments where I'm like, good Lord, this is a lot. But, that's also what I'm kind of attracted to with that.
Could I earn it?
Yeah. I mean, that's like, you know, like we were up above the Aspen watching them change colors and a little bit of snow on the peaks. And, you know, we literally heard and basically watched all the elk move down, deeper into the drainages because of the weather. Like that's to me is such an awesome experience. You know, so yeah, it's kind of a tangent, but.
No, it's good. That's kind of what podcasts are.
Just a big tangent. This is all this is.
But I think exercise is important. And, like, my own, you know, kind of outside my normal, like, running and weightlifting and training like that is, like, I've got an 18-month-old kid who's, you know, a little cannonball. And I put him in one of those kid carriers and, like, walk around with him. Like, just doing stuff like that. There's tons of resources out there for people that want to get involved on the fitness side. Like, while I think it's important, I don't think we're going to go too much into it. We tend to lean on the food side, not the fitness side, but it's an important aspect nonetheless. And I think it's very key to have in your mind when you're kind of thinking forward to this, you know, whether you're going to come out to Colorado and hunt. If you look at the way elk are scattered throughout most of the U.S., like, you're going to find them in mountainous areas at certain varying amounts of elevation. But I think just being prepared is a fun thing to do. It helps add to that success factor down the road.
Yeah, I don't think you could go into it and be like, wow, I'm just way too prepared for this. I'm in way too good a shape.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, there's no cap on
say no one shape. Ever
yeah and it's good for you anyway, so you know, it's like it's a win-win.
So let's touch a little bit on gear. So I think both Ben and I took an approach to kind of do a very like ultra light gear sort of rundown. Like, I don't know what we weighed my pack at the truck, and it was like 42 pounds, and that included like tent, sleeping bag, food for 5 days, water initially to go in with, plus like all the hunting stuff, plus like, I mean, pretty much everything you need to survive. Rain gear, pack covers, game bags, knives, like all the things you could think. Like, pretty slimmed down as much as I could get it. And then your pack was lighter.
Yeah, somewhere around there. I think it was about the same, but with my bow. So it was like a little bit lighter, but yeah, it's, I mean, from like backpacking world before this, before I got into hunting, it was like, you know, I've done the 75 pound pack, you know, silliness.
I've done it too, yeah.
Where, you know, and I did it in Colorado and was super unprepared and just got my ass kicked and did one of those kind of trips where pretty much every day I'm going through my pack and getting rid of food and like dumping out stuff and just,
I have to eat,
like,
all this food right now.
Yeah, like just being like, well, this bag of oatmeal, I haven't touched it. I have 8 pounds of it, you know, and dumping it out and all that. So throughout the years, I've really kind of dialed everything down and get as light as possible. Like, the big things are your sleep system and your shelter and food. As far as like where a lot of weight comes from, I think I wrote this in a blog or something. I wrote it for somewhere. If you've never figured out how much food you eat, you probably have no idea how much food you're eating. And I've found that people either grossly overestimate or underestimate, you know, like I see guys in some of these forums all the time. They're like, oh, I definitely eat like 3,500 calories a day, so I bring 6,000 calories worth of food in the mountains, and I double everything. And I'm like, you probably don't. That's a ton of food.
Yeah,
that's
a ton.
Like an absurd amount of food to eat every day.
I just stuck with like my normal consumption. Like I shoot for around like 2,000, 2,500 calories. Like it's kind of my daily, my normal day-to-day kind of calorie consumption. And so that's what I shoot for when I'm out. But I'm also looking for like those, the lightweight food that's high caloric value that I know my body's going to burn off quick, but be able to burn off. So they're really like complex carbohydrates. Obviously, we're going to talk a little bit about dehydrated meals in just a second, but plenty of those, you know, and you and I have different approaches to food as well.
Yeah, I feel like I, in general, I kind of do the same thing. It's about 2,200 calories. I was always taught by people that I used to backpack with, you should be planning to lose some weight in the mountains. Unless you're super, super skinny and you're super, super lean, you probably have at least 10 pounds extra weight, you know, on you, even with all the stuff I do. I definitely do.
I got on the scale. I lost 6 pounds, so I fit the model of like a pound a day.
Pound a day. Yeah, I really often lose a pound a day. The dude Craig that we were with said he lost 3 belt loops this season.
Yeah, and he was out for, what, 15 days, I think?
20
days?
20-something. Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, that those high saturated fats, you know, like nut kind of stuff, anything that's like all that nut butter and, like, chia energy balls, like all
Snickers.
Those things I like a lot. Justin's got Snickers. I got Reese's. Gotta have something sweet after dinner, so
yeah.
I always have Reese's. I have those. I like those complete cookies a lot, and those kind of, you know, things that are like 400 calories. I don't like to have to whip out the jet boil on the stove 3-4 times a day.
Yeah, that is true.
You know, so I make coffee in the morning, really strong coffee. A lot of times,
coffee too. Instant coffee.
Yeah, strong instant coffee.
Yep.
And then this year, I used to always do oatmeal. In the morning, and I kind of cut that for the most part, and I've just got this condensed milk that's like the Vietnamese kind of style coffee that's like 140 calories, and I can just pour that in there. I got my coffee and I got a little meal, and I'm good to go, good to start the day. And
I did one, so I brought oatmeal this time for breakfast, and I ended up not eating it because we had a concern, because we had to go travel to get water and then, like, carry water up in elevation, like, to where we're camping, and it was just kind of like a big mess to kind of deal with. So my concern once I got out there was, like, I love to eat oatmeal. On a normal day-to-day, I eat oatmeal almost every day. But up there I didn't, because now I'm like, I have to use extra water to, like, clean up my jet boil and, like, get everything sort of clean so I can pack it back in my bag and, you know, move around with it without it being all gunked up with oatmeal. So I actually didn't eat any oatmeal, and I think I would lean more the side of, like, Clif Bars or granola bars or something like that to sort of take the place. And I think if you did a side-by-side comparison to like some of those bars to like a packet of like oatmeal, you would probably find the nutritional values equitable.
Yeah.
So, and it's, it causes less mess and uses less water.
It's like a time thing with me too. I, even though I, you know, obviously get up early to hunt, I'm definitely one of these people who I'm always hitting snooze a few too many times.
it happened a couple times.
I'm always running like a little late in the morning, and you know, I'm definitely, even though I love doing it, I love being out, I'm still one of these people who wakes up every day and I'm like, just not happy about it. So I mean, if I can limit time, you know, so. Because if you do the dehydrated meals in the morning, you gotta rehydrate, you know, and you could be just sitting there for a half hour when you should be out. So, and that's the same reason why I have stuff for in the middle of the day. You know, I have like caffeine infused goos and gels and those kind of things, so I don't have to stop and make coffee, because a lot of times I'm on something in the middle of the day, or you know, I'm hiking in the middle of the day and I don't want to have to stop and take all the stuff out and let stuff rehydrate. So really I'm only doing the one, dehydrated meal a day for dinner or whatever.
Yeah. And I, now as we're talking about dehydrated meals, so I'm typically a mountain house guy. Like, I enjoy the Mountain House flavors. This year I did try to mix it up some, and gosh, I can't remember what I went with now. Something else that was
Backpacker's Pantry.
Backpacker's Pantry was one, and
gosh, I don't remember the other one. I
can't remember the other
one. The cheap ones.
Yeah, the cheaper ones. They're cheaper than Mountain House.
With the black and green kind of packaging.
Yeah, I think so. They're called. I like the flavors. There are a couple that I was not okay with. Even the Backpacker's Pantry.
But I
tend to, so I really like the beef stroganoff from Mountain House. So I got like a bunch of, I got that flavor from a bunch of different ones, and I was fairly happy with. There was some that I was like, nope. But
yeah, I really like the Peak Refuels this year. They're definitely the most expensive, which is the only reason why I don't buy a ton of them. But it tastes like real food. And when you look at the ingredients, it is real food. And, you know, it's like all of the flavors I've had of there so far, like you eat it and you're like, oh, that's not bad. Like if you were home, you'd be like, this is pretty good. Like this came out pretty good compared to like, I mean, I've had some, I remember on one trip I took with my dad, I got like this super organic brand was on sale. And I eat anything, and I ended up throwing a bunch of them out. It tasted like dog food. Like, it was like seasoned dog food. So ooh. You definitely, you know, I don't know. There's good flavors. I like the Lasagna Mountain House.
Yeah, that one's good.
But I feel like I'm just burnt out on them.
Yeah, at this point, I'm really done.
Yeah.
I do need to take a break.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
I did want to mention one thing, though, and this was like a last-minute ad, like those electrolyte tabs. I forget, the NUN. I think my wife, like, tossed them to me as I was heading out the door. She was at some sort of a health fair or whatever and picked up, like, the grab bag, and they were in there. And she's like, oh, you probably want to take these on your trip. And I never thought about it because I'm normally, like, coffee and water. But I think that those seriously saved my ass because when the first couple days we were out, it was hot. And when we were pushing up to elevation and we carried up water, which added, like, another 15 pounds to my pack, I was just like, I didn't eat that morning either. I was like, oh, I'll stop and get something. And then we started hearing elk bugle and, like, skipped lunch. Ben yelled at me for making coffee in the middle of the day while the elk are bugling. And I was like, dude, I got to stop for a minute. But I ended up putting two of those tabs in like two cups of water, and just like that brought me back to life. And then I kind of stuck with it doing one per day because I realized I was like, I'm eating Mountain House, I'm eating all these other like bars and processed foods and all this other things. I'm not saying these tablets are not processed because they obviously are, but it's just, I think it kind of helped restore some retention of water and other things back into my body that I needed, which was pretty vital. So I got home and I told my wife, I was like, thank you so much for giving me those tabs, because otherwise I wouldn't have even thought to throw them in my pack. And I think now they've landed them a permanent place. Plus it's like a cool fizzy drink because they fizz when you drop in the water. And that was like, add a little,
it's like lemon lime.
Yeah, so. Add a little bouginess to my water consumption. So, let's switch gears a little bit, though. Let's just go right into the trips. So, Ben, you kind of talked about your past year in Oregon, but let's really, if you hit some of the highlights from this year.
Sure, yeah. I mean, so, as usual, didn't scout as much as I wanted to. I had some key areas kind of picked out. I found some really cool areas. And it was kind of, for the first 2 weeks of the season, it was like, right place, wrong time. It just seemed like I was like a little
bit behind. So what was your expectation going into it?
I don't know. I felt pretty good.
Did you build an expectation from last year based on this year?
Definitely, because I was like, okay, I was going to spend the first 2 weeks on the Coast Range,
mm-hmm.
And kind of, you know, just spot hop a lot, and there was a lot of areas I wanted to spend more time in that I knew elk were hanging out at, and my expectations were low there. I had two really cool encounters with the same herd. Well, I guess three kind of longer encounters. And both times they kind of gave me the slip. But this was all kind of like the warm-up, I felt like, for Eastern Oregon, because I hiked pretty close to 100 miles in that area last year, all over the place. There were some slow days in between encounters where I was like, I'm just going to hike all over this mountain and figure out what they're doing and see where they're going. And so with that in my back pocket, I was like, you know, I was feeling pretty good about that. I felt like there was a pretty good chance I would get an elk there. And then to finish out the season, which I had been hoping would be peak rut in Colorado, I was feeling pretty good. My expectations in retrospect were definitely a little high. I thought for sure I was going to get an elk this year. I mean, a lot of my strategy is just like grinding out, you know, like I'm like, all right, I looked at all the stats and your average elk hunter is out for 6 days. So if I'm out for 30 days, I just quintupled my chances. you know, and that's not exactly how it worked out, but so Coast Range stuff, got some new spots there to check out, but just like kept missing them. Super elky. I heard very few bugles, but yeah, overall what I experienced and what a lot of people that I've talked to that were out have experienced, a later than usual rut. Really quiet bugle year, you know, water, like a super dry year, so they're not in the same places just because they, you know, need different water sources.
Almost no wallows.
Yeah, there was, I mean, I found one in the Coast Range the first week of the season, but everything was kind of dried up. Yeah, and just like an overall, they're not in the usual places was kind of like a theme that I heard over and over. They're not where they usually are, so it was a lot of like moving around. It was definitely, you know, as a whitetail hunter, like that's kind of my background with hunting. It's really hard to get out of the mindset of like, there's a ton of sign here, they're going to come back in the area, you know, and like for whitetail, that's a really good strategy most of the time. Like if you're on fresh sign, you're on fresh rubs and scrapes and there's, you know, poop everywhere, you're probably going to run into them if you sit there long enough. But elk, it's like a whole different thing, you know, so that was something I was figuring out this year. It was like, you know, towards the latter end of those few weeks, if I was out for two sits and I didn't in a spot and I didn't hear anything, see anything, I'm moving. And I just kept moving and moving. Yeah, you know, the hot spot in Eastern Oregon, I saw four elk and they were all while I was driving. And they all ran in front of my truck at like 50 miles an hour. They'd been blown out of somewhere else and I could never catch up with them again. So I basically headed to Colorado early on that because I was like, you know, there's four times the amount of elk in about a quarter of the space. So I might as well. And I love Colorado anyway. I've only been, you know, spent time there once, here once. So I was like, or I'll just head out early.
Yep, because we had had plans to hook up and do some hunting. Like we had scouted. He scouted and picked out a spot and basically gone for it. And then, so I had my buddy Craig. So if you remember back from episode 323, Craig and I went Osceola turkey hunting in Florida and got to hang out for 3 or 4 days. Well, Craig's also a big elk hunter as well. So he came out and hunted in Colorado and was actually... the same time Ben was out in Oregon, Craig was out in Colorado, and I kept trying to get away to go out and go join him, and just it was not lining up for me to even break free for a couple days due to some other travel. So when I heard Ben was coming out early, I just connected him and Craig.
Yeah.
And the like stars aligned.
Yeah, which really I was like, this is predestined. I'm going to shoot an elk with this guy. So basically we had e-scouted probably like 6 units pretty well.
Yep.
And I finally was just like, I heard probably 4 out of 6 of them were circus, And I just was like, let's just do this one. I'm going to be out early. I'll spend some time in there. And if there's no luck, we'll keep moving. And we come to find out that Craig is going to the exact same area. And that it's...
Not only the exact same unit, the exact same parking lot. Like, trailhead.
At the same time.
Yep.
Like, you know, and I was like, I sent him the pin a couple times because I was like, you're going here and you're going to be there at 3 p.m.? And he's like, yeah, exactly then. And he basically was like... He had been getting into elk in another unit, but there was a lot of pressure and a lot of, I think he just called it silliness that he'd been dealing with. And this was a spot that he was going to where he was like, this is my honey hole pretty much. And he had seen a lot of elk in the years before. So I was like, as far as expectations, I was like riding really high because I was like, this is all lining up. Because I'm going to shoot an elk with this dude. Or at the very least, he's going to shoot one. Or we're at the very, very least going to get into a lot of elk. You know, and he kind of told me straight up, like, it's a hard hike. The reason why they're up there is because nobody wants to go there. You know, we were basically going about 2 miles above where outfitters are doing drop camps. So, like, we're going in there. And I was like, yeah, let's do it. I'm down. Yeah.
Do you want to talk about, like, kind of what you guys saw while you were up there and, like, the week before I made it out?
Yeah, I mean, so overall, we were camping at just about 10,000 feet, and we had quite a few encounters at about 10.4 to 10.8. They were up high.
So let's clarify this. So, like, could you define what an encounter is, because we're going to talk more and we're going to use that word pretty synonymous and I don't want people to be like, oh my god, they were like an elk chased them. Like,
yeah, I would call an encounter like an interaction that lasts more than a few seconds or is like really close, you know. Like, I would call it, like, there was a couple times where I bumped a herd at 15 yards, you know. I'd call that an encounter. Just basically when you're doing maybe a little more than just seeing an animal. Like, if I'm glassing something at 700 yards, I don't know if I'd really call that an encounter unless it turns into, like, me moving, you know, and then I get into them. But, yeah, just maybe, I guess, a rough definition would be, like, a little more than seeing them. Mm-hmm. A little more, you know, a little more, like, maybe they bugled back a couple times or you heard a couple chuckles or, you know, you got a little dialogue going with them, or, you know, maybe you just bump the herd a couple times and you're kind of stalking them. Like, anything in those veins, okay. I would call encounters.
So you guys had a couple encounters.
Yeah, we had bumped some cows a couple times in the pretty thick, like, aspen part. You know, and the one really good encounter, this elk bugled right at the top of this mountain at 10.8. Right away to a soft cow call, and he was kind of bugling all night as we worked our way up there, all late afternoon or whatever. And we were in, like, a pretty picture-perfect, like, elk setup. There was a nice funnel. I was up front as a shooter, like, maybe probably 60, 70 yards from Craig, who was doing some calling. The bull was super responsive to the calls. It seemed like he might have had a herd with him. We heard a little bit of cow calling. Yeah, but I mean, he would kind of cow call, wait a few minutes, you know, and then the elk would bugle back. He'd be closer, he'd be further away. He just wouldn't come down into this funnel. Basically, you know, and I was standing there super ready to shoot this thing. I would have had, like, a perfect shot at 40 yards, you know. And he just would not come in. He would not come in. He started getting a little more aggressive, or Craig started getting a little more aggressive with the calling, and he was just right up there at 100 yards. You know, the wind was perfect. And I stood there until, you know, I couldn't see a thing, and I finally just, you know, walked down to Craig, and I was like, you know, it's past shooting light. You know, it's a bummer, but we'll get him in the morning or whatever. And we probably walked about 100 yards, and we heard him rip down the mountain to about where we were standing. And he was just bugling and going crazy. We heard him raking, and it was like, oh, my God. It was like 10 more minutes. But, you know, I think about that kind of stuff all the time. It's like, he came down. He didn't, like, accidentally come down when it was dark. He came down because it was dark, you know, and he'd be a little safer.
You play to his advantage, like...
Yeah, exactly. He's on the top of the mountain, coming down. It'll be dark. He knows right where, you know, he thinks the bull is. And, yeah, like, just missed him. So that was... But that was the first day we were in, up there. So I was like, this is great. And lots of bugling in the next 5 days. There were lots of elk, but they weren't, you know... They weren't standing still. They were kind of... We're up above an area where you could hear, like, probably into 6 drainages, and you could hear really well all the way across into this other mountain range. Like, it was a really good area for figuring out where they are, but they just didn't want to come in. and then, you know, they'd kind of do the one bugle at 5, another bugle at 5:30, and they're like 400 yards further away, and then another one at 6, and they're like, you know, 1,000 yards away, and then it was kind of quiet for most of the day, and then we'd kind of pick up at night, get into, you know, a couple bugling elk, and maybe they'd come closer, we'd go closer, but that was the first real, that was like the best solid encounter that I had in those first few days. And that was probably like a solid hour and a half thing with that bull, which was really cool. I mean, that's what I really love about this. It's like so interactive compared to other styles of hunting I've done.
And reminds me of like turkey hunting.
Yeah, turkey hunting, except they're huge and angry, and like, you know, there's just something. And I mean, the sounds that they make too are just so awesome. It's like,
it's cool,
you know. It's really like ghostly almost, and like otherworldly. And I had even read somewhere that it took biologists a long time to figure out how they were even making the sound, because it doesn't, I guess it's something in their nasal cavity that they can do or whatever. But yeah, so I mean, we got into them, but there was no shot opportunity, and it seemed like they were kind of moved lower a little bit, and then Craig had to go, and that kind of timed up with
when I was coming in.
When yeah. Justin was coming in, yeah.
And then you had an encounter in between the period where you were like, yeah. Solo.
Yeah, so I mean, I was going to go back down the mountain to get more food and to get Justin. I wanted to make sure he didn't get lost. You know, there's no cell phone service, and I don't think he has an inReach or anything. So mm-hmm. I was like, it'll just be, you know, better and safer for everybody if we go down. I just go back down. I got to get more food anyway. I'd only brought food for like 6 days or 5 days or whatever. So I got down the mountain a lot quicker than I thought. And there was another area that we had e-scouted. And I was like, oh, I got just about the perfect amount of time to get up there. So I go up this mountain. It was like an hour hike. You know, I was really kind of huffing it because it was already 6 o'clock. So I get up to the top of this area, and, you know, this is a true multiple-use area. You know, there's people fishing in the streams, there's people hiking, there's people walking their dogs. You know, this was a little bit closer to the trailhead, so, you know, saw some people and kind of were talking to them, and they were like, oh, there's no elk up here, we haven't seen elk. Like, they, you know, they had said they'd been there for 3 days and hadn't seen an elk, you know, they were just hiking. But, and then I get to the top of this area, you know, and it's kind of overlooking this one little mountain, you know, and there's some thick timber, and I look down at my feet, and carved in the sand in big letters is no elk. So I was like, well, this is probably a waste of time, but, you know, I'm up here now, so I'm just gonna sit here. And And, you know, I didn't hear anything until 7:05, and then I heard a possible bugle, and I was like, that might be a hunter, you know, and I kind of just started heading towards it. At this point, I think I had less than 20 minutes of shooting light, and then this bull just started ripping bugles, like bugle after bugle, and I'm like, that is definitely not a hunter. So I started with the previous encounter in mind. I'm like, I have 15 minutes to probably make it a half mile to this bull. And I just started huffing it. You know, I'd do a cow call, he'd rip a bugle. I basically would do anything and he would rip a bugle immediately. And I just, in retrospect, I just kind of blacked out and ran towards this thing. I mean,
no plan.
I wish I had a better explanation for it, but and then I misjudged. You know, I was like so concerned with getting to the bull. It was one lone bull. You know, he had no herd with him, that I just totally overlooked any kind of plan, and I misjudged how far away he was, and he ripped off these two awesome bugles right in a row, and I was like, that's probably like 150, and I went another 30 yards, and I'm looking at antlers, and my last thought was, oh no, those look like antlers, and he's looking right at me, and you know, I checked after, and the wind was blowing right at him, and he just took off the mountain, bugling his head off the whole way. But yeah, so he was probably, if I had slowed down, I don't know, you know, it's hard to say, you always do the Monday morning quarterback thing, but if I had slowed down and creeped into that spot, I would have had a really nice, like, 30, 40-yard shot at this bull, but that's not what happened, you know, and it's like, it was, you know, what works on one bull doesn't work on the other, and, you know, it was kind of like too slow maybe the night before, or, you know, just a little too late, and I had that in my mind, and then I just messed it up by doing it a little too early and just kind of rushing in. So I was kind of laughing at myself for doing that. And then also just like the funny irony of the, you know, it's literally carved in the sand that there's no elk here. And I had a, you know, what was my closest encounter yet at the time. Mm-hmm. So it ended up being pretty cool, but yeah. And he got up to this mountain that was like at 8,600 feet in, I don't know, a minute.
Yeah.
And then he was just ripping bugles up there like, you know, all right, now I'll come fight you. Come up here. So it was pretty cool encounter. But yeah, totally blew it. Like, there's no other way to put it other than that. I blew it.
It's a bummer. I couldn't imagine running into that and just being like, no. I mean, I could, because I've done it with other things where you're like, wait a minute. Is you kind of like squint and turn your head sideways, yeah, and you're like, those look wait like a minute. Antlers,
and then it just busted out.
It's too late. So, yeah. And then the next day, you and I met up and headed up the trail. You came, met me down in the parking lot, and so you resupplied, and then we headed up. And so our attention was, we had one camp because I got there a little later in the afternoon than what I was planning. So our first camp was kind of off the main trail, and then we'd branch off and head up to the higher camp the next day, which we did. And then we actually, that second morning, so the first hike in, the first like 4 miles was pretty uneventful. But the second morning, we were both still in our tent, kind of hitting the snooze button, and that's when we heard that bugle.
Yeah, we heard a big bugle, like, right where we were going, and Justin was like, did you hear that? And I was like, yep. And we're, you know, scrambling to get ready. And
yeah, I actually left my paracord there. Oh, I forgot to check for it when we went back. Somebody probably picked it up. That's okay. Yeah, we scrambled to try to get up and into position to, like, move that direction. But, man, I will say that was a very challenging hike from that point forward. And it was probably, like, 6 miles, I think, from camp one up to where camp two was, and we had to do water, you know, I had to stop for water once, and then just to get water and coffee, which we can tell that story, because then we think an elk that both had a very distinct bugle. You want to give us an idea of what the bugle is?
It kind of, to me, I've been telling it to people, it sounded like a person imitating a wolf.
Yeah.
Like, he was just like, roar. Yeah, like that would be the whole bugle, roar.
But he would like consistently call back, even while I was up there. But we heard him. I mean, we were probably like maybe 1,500 yards from where he would have been.
Yeah,
estimated.
Probably closer.
And you know, I was kind of like taking my time. I was really tired. I needed a break, and I was like, "All right, we gotta get water." And oh yeah, I'm gonna make some coffee. Vince, like, losing his mind.
Yeah,
like, no, we need to go find this, like, bull, like, now.
I was like, we're on this bull. Like, we have to go get him, you know. And
like, yeah, man. I just make
like,
quick coffee.
I really need to make coffee. So I was like, okay, all right. Okay.
I didn't eat breakfast that point, and it was like, that was where I mentioned.
You didn't eat breakfast either, yeah.
It was not a great start of the day.
I was like, all right, you know, and you know, kind of in line with the season. As soon as we got pretty close, he totally clammed up. And
yeah,
we didn't hear him until we got, until we were like, we were loaded up with the water. I mean, I think I was bringing up like 9 liters. Just, you know, the water spot was, you know, basically it was a, it's a tough 6 miles the second half. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we're, the parking lot I think is at like 6,300 feet, and the second camp is right at 10,000 or 10,200. So like a lot, and almost all the elevation gain is in the last 4 miles. So,
yep.
And the water was, the closest water we found was 900 feet down, you know, just like the usual nonsense with the high country and water. So, so we just like really, really loaded up. I gave Justin a 5 liter plastic thing, and mm-hmm. I had my own, and you know, we had, I guess, like about 9 liters each, strapped to the packs and any which way. And I think we started hearing him again once we got to the top. And we were both pretty wiped. I wasn't super hot. I'm going right back down into there. But
we did get up top and do some bugles, and like he was responsive.
They Justin showed up the day that they all started bugling for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd bugle and I mean all day, you know, and we have footage of they're bugling at 11:30, 2 p.m. all day long. We'd bugle, they'd respond.
But they were like all over. Like there was
they were
where
really
our camp was definitely at the top of like two distinct drainage. One which we came up and made several trips up and down, trying to get at this same bull who just kind of liked that spot. No matter where he'd move away to, he'd move back into it.
Yeah.
But when we'd get down to him, he would just like go quiet. And we must have been within 200 yards, 100 yards. And like we sat there, I think one day, it was the third or fourth day, we sat there for like 2 hours.
Waited. Mean, I thought we were like really in his zone. We could hear him raking really well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, and we just, there was no sign of him, really.
No, it was super thick. I mean, it was a mix of pine and aspen and just, like, a lot of brush everywhere.
You could see why they were in there.
Oh, yeah.
It was just one of those areas, you know, it's 900 feet down, super steep. The wind was super funky, like, whatever wet, you know, we were, like, waiting for thermals to switch, and then the wind would start swirling, and it was, like, just one of these, like, perfect elky drainages where it's, like, if you get in there, he's going to be in there, but good luck getting in there. And that's why they're there, you know, because it's hard to get to.
And I think that that's important to point out is, like, that was kind of our strategy throughout was, like, and later we figured the key, but we never got to test it because the weather kind of turned on us. We'll hit on that in just a second. But bugling from up top, they were very responsive. But as you started going down closer to them, they would clam up. And, you know, Ben and I discussed it, and you referenced, like, there's sort of some scientific thought behind it of, like, elk not wanting to challenge another elk that's at the high ground, and like we're coming from up high down low, so they may think like, oh, they have the advantage. Completely just a BS theory we have, but mind, like, it makes sense
stuff too. Yeah. It seemed like the rut was later, so I think a lot of it too was like they were willing to be like, hey, I'm over here if you want to fight or whatever, and then when they get close to, like, you know, they're just not down yet. They weren't ready to have that, like, blowout fight. They were still kind of tolerant. Like, they were all, like, the bachelor groups were split up, for sure. Like, bulls, there was, like, a bull in each drainage, but they were not, you know, they didn't want to come up.
Yeah.
They didn't want to come down. Like, if you go down, they just got totally quiet, and I think they were just, you know, I think in another week, if we went back and did the same thing, it probably would be on. We'd be able to either call some up, or at least have, you know, interactions with them that are more, that were closer, because, I mean, all the bugles on top were probably, like, some of them might have been 1,000 yards. Like, you could really hear well in this area.
So then another thing that happened while we were there, and we knew this was going to happen, is on Tuesday the cold front was coming through. And
that's when they turned on with the bugles.
And it was preceding that cold front. And then the cold front hit, and, like, the first day was okay because it was just kind of rain and stuff off and on. And then
they really clammed up that day. We didn't get much. And then that night, things kind of turned a little south for us, more like just Ben and I, and not from a hunting perspective, more of like a just being out there perspective. I think we were out, we were up at elevation. We thought all the storms had kind of passed, and then we were up above our camp on the ridge listening to the adjacent set of drainages to the east, and we're actually listening to hunters sort of shuffle elk around and elk move and all this other stuff. And then I noticed, I was like, I think that's a storm coming. Like, we should probably start pushing back down. At that point, it was already cold. We pushed down and decided not to get our rain gear on in time because we just thought it was going to go. And that was when the grouse, we got the grouse too.
Yeah.
Which, that was cool.
Yeah, we definitely, well, at least I did, committed, like, the fatal. I think a lot of it was, like, it was almost dark, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you're dark, it's almost dark, you're tired, you're heading back to camp anyway. And I kind of was, like, waited a little bit to put rain gear on. So I got a little bit wet, and then I put the rain gear on. And then
Your rain gear
got really wet. And I have decent rain gear, but it was, like, really coming down. And then we heard a bugle that was pretty close in the one drainage, and I was like, I'm going down. Ended up really wet, even with the rain gear.
Yeah.
And then it rained for the next 20 yep. hours.
We got into our tents. Like, we got back to camp, and there's like,
it was, I think, like 6:30. Like, yeah. It was early. We were joking about, like, oh, we'll get a good night's sleep at least. And
well, we got into our tents at 6:30, 7, whatever it was, and we did not leave our tents until 11 o'clock the next morning.
Yeah, and by then it had rained, sleeted, hailed, and snowed.
Yep, all in that. And so then we got into, and the temperature was absolutely frigid.
It was cold,
And so now we're looking at, like, the only really dry spots are in our tents. You know, luckily we were fairly dry.
Mm-hmm.
My tent was completely dry. I'll give a shout out. We both had Nemo tents. This was the first year I had ever used it. I bought it. I think it was mine, the Hornet, the two person, because I like to have a little space inside, a little wiggle room. And it absolutely performed phenomenal. The inside stayed dry. Condensation was minimal. It kept my gear kind of on the outside edge, like the rain cover extended mm-hmm. beyond the width of the tent, and so I could tuck my pack and my bow and other stuff, and it kept that stuff dry.
I have the same one as a one person, mm-hmm. and these are, you know, single-walled three-person tents, or three-season tents, rather. And there was enough room to keep my stuff dry, you know, keep myself dry. Like, I was really pleased with it. You know, I don't think I wouldn't take it out super late season with 2 feet of snow, mm-hmm. but, like, I was super impressed because, you know, they're both ultralight tents. Mine, the single person, is sub 2 pounds. I think it's 1 pound, 10 ounces, and Justin's about 2 pounds.
Yep.
So, I mean, to have, you know, and that's kind of the toss-up is, like, do you go too ultralight and you end up stuck in a bivy for a day and a half? So, yeah, we were both, like, just really impressed with how well they did, and
I think it was definite saving grace too, because we at that point, had we gotten wet and with the cold, and you know, we started trying to do a fire and like couldn't get a fire going, everything was too wet, like the snow is dripping from the trees, like we just
yeah, it was looking pretty, like, I mean, we basically were like, you know, I was like, if we don't get any kind of sun or anything today, we're probably going to have to go down because everything is wet. You know, like the little bit of condensation on, like I had gotten my down jacket a little wet. I had the sleeping bag was just a little bit of condensation. The down sleeping bag I have, which cooks off, you know, I'd cooked off no problem during the day earlier, as long as it's basically not
mm-hmm.
super cold and wet. But yeah, so I was a little worried about that, where I was like, you know, and then the rain gear was just soaked through. And we basically each had like just the set of clothes we were wearing that were still dry.
Yeah.
And I was like, we were gonna call it.
My pants were still wet. I only had one pair of pants.
Yeah.
And they were wet, but I was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And we set a timeline. We were like, look, if the sun's not out by 1 p.m., like
we're gonna have to head back to the truck like a day and a half, 2 days early, just because
we
didn't want to get, because we were thinking, you know, I was able to send a message to my girlfriend with the SpotX, and she was like, it's supposed to rain the rest of the week, pretty much. So I was like, okay, it's going to snow up here. You know, we don't want to get, like,
stuck.
Actually snowed in, where we're, like, post-hauling for 6 miles and 2 feet of snow, which is not fun.
So you kind of, you don't know, that definitely sets into realism real quick. It's like, oh, I can't look at the radar, I can't look at the weather predictions.
Yeah,
like,
we're not sure. We just got to see how it goes and kind of look at the sky and hope.
Yep.
And, yeah, we lucked out. The sun came out.
For about 2 hours?
Yeah, and that was, I mean, we had, like, I had all my clothes out on rocks and stuff.
Yep.
And it was, like, just enough before the next storm came in later to get everything dry, where I was, like, totally comfortable with staying.
Well, we moved. So we also were like, look, also the elk are no longer up here. Like, there are no elk above us.
There was none above us in the 5 days. They were all below us. So we decided to move down and to make sure, you know, at least it would be rain and not snow or whatever. So
we got our tents dry, we got our clothes dry, and we packed up everything, and we moved down to elevation. Spent the afternoon, like, trying for bugles and just waiting, and it was really quiet. We had one bugle, like, right before we crawled into our tents that night. One bugle.
You heard a few, I think. They were just, like, way
off
on the other side of the mountain. Yeah, I couldn't even hear them, and Justin would be like, yeah, that's our guy. But, that was kind of what kept me up there for those many days, was you could hear so well. So I was like, at the very least, we know what's going on in the area. And then once we ducked into the drainages, it was tough to hear anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's thick aspen, and, you know, there was that outfitter right there. So any elk that are in the general area, they get hunted all year hard. So
I would say we had one. It was that same day too, because it was while we were up top drying gear, we heard a hunter bugling the next drainage over, and then we hear an elk cross the top of the drainage. Like, I could hear it breaking brush, I could hear it moving, mm-hmm. and then we hear it subsequently over the next, like, hour bugle, like, five or six times as it moves down, and that's the one that covered, he must have covered 5 miles.
Easily, yeah.
Within that hour and a half.
Yeah, it was really neat. It was almost like, you know, we had a bird's eye view up there of what hunting pressure does with elk. And the day before, we had the same thing where we heard this hunter, and I mean, I've done it, you know. The elk was bugling like crazy. He would respond to the calls, but the elk was running away from him.
or in the desperation.
Yeah, and you could hear, like, the hunter would bugle, and he'd bugle, and he'd be like, you know. And I mean, this went on for probably a solid hour and a half, where it's just like, the elk is here, and the guy bugles, and, you know, there's no response. Bugles again, and then the elk responds, and then they try to close the distance, and, you know, the elk is here, and he goes to there, and then the elk is gone, and the elk is up here and bugles. And it was like, it was pretty funny and also, like, very enlightening to be like, okay, next time you're in this situation, this all you're doing is just chasing the thing around, and it's going to win every time on a foot race, you know, between you and an elk. It's, you know, and just seeing how quickly they can navigate so far and just be like, they're 6 miles away, and you're still standing there wondering, you know, oh, am I in its zone? He might be sub 100, and he's gone. Like,
yeah.
So that was pretty neat to watch and pretty enlightening.
And so then now we find ourselves waking up the morning of, like, the last day, and, like, we're rip a few bugles, just kind of waiting. It's like all quiet. So we just decide, like, at this point, we're like, meh.
Yeah, last day of the season. That was, like, I feel like I woke up that day and the whole month just hit me. Like, I woke up, and I think we woke up at, like, 6, and I was like, good Lord, I'm so tired.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've been out so much this month, and it just, like, I'm pretty much done. And, yeah, so we started working our way out, packed up.
Yep. Kind of slow hunted our way, bugled, cow called.
Yeah, we bugled like, a little bit, just kind of like the Hail Mary, and
got down by camp one. We were also soaking wet again because it rained that more. Night. It rained more that night throughout the most
and then
of the night.
Was like just ton everything. It wasn't raining as we were hiking, but everything was soaked. So we were like, you know.
And we confirmed, too, it had snowed a ton back up at the top of the mountain. So we probably would have got inundated again and had to deal with that whole scenario. So I think, in retrospect, we definitely made a good decision by moving down elevation.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, you know, I was like, I wanted to stay up because we could hear, but it just, it would have been kind of dangerous and kind of silly, you know. And with everything being wet, it was like, Justin was like, well, tonight it's all going to freeze. Like, all this stuff is going to freeze. And then, you know, then you're in a very different situation. Everything is frozen. So it was kind of, we had to, you know, definitely made the right call by moving down.
So then we're out and we get, you know, we do, it's what, 4 miles, I think, to camp one? No, it's...
Yeah, like 6 down to camp one, and then like 4.5 to the trailhead.
So we get down to camp one, and we had to change socks, and we take a break, and like...
Yeah, I wrung out my socks and dumped water out of my boots, and that was just from everything being so wet. But yeah, and we hiked through, you know, and I think I had even said at one point, like, you know, there's definitely elk closer to the truck, but this area... Not so much in this area because it's like a canyon. You're basically walking through a canyon the first few miles, so there's probably not going to be any elk there. So
we're just bebopping along.
Yeah, we're just chatting and, you know, we're like walking and talking, and all of a sudden we heard just loud brake brush like maybe 10 yards in front of us.
And which I thought when you were like, you're like, stop, because I was probably 10 yards behind
you. He was a little back.
Yeah.
And
I thought you were like, it's a bear, because I had expected us to, within camp one and the parking lot, it was more likely we would run across a bear.
We had a lot of weird run-ins with hikers, and there must have been somebody up there hunting bears or something. Every single person asked us if we had seen bears and if we were hunting bears. So we were like, Justin was like, okay, this is a bear hunt now. Like,
I had my bear tag too, so I was prepared.
Yeah, so I mean, I took a couple steps forward to see what it was, and it was easily the biggest bull I've ever seen in the field, including at like elk refuges and Yellowstone and areas like that. But all I could see, the brush was so thick and it was steep, all I could see was the top of his eyes and this huge rack. And so I'm there, like, I'm just like, trying to get Justin to stop walking first, and I'm going like, it's a bull, and he's going like, it's a bear? Is it a bear? What is it? And I'm like, it's a bull, and, you know, and I'm like freaking out, you know. I probably like 30 yards tops, 30-40, and you know, the wind was just going right up into his face, and he just had seen enough, and he just booked it up this almost vertical canyon, which I tried to chase him after, but it was like such a perfect kind of ending. And I had set a loose goal of having more encounters this year than last year, and that put it over the edge where I had ended up having more encounters this year. But man, it was like, it was such a bummer way to end it, in a way, you know, where I was like, oh my God, if we were just a little slower, a little quieter, he probably was just standing right in the trail.
Yeah.
But
who knows?
Yeah, I mean, but that's the deal. You know, I feel like I've done it with every species. I've been on hunts where it's like you can't stay in that zone where you're just creeping around for, you know, 10 hours. Like, you know, and we had really written off that we were going to see anything that close to the truck. And it was just a really popular area. There was even that morning, there was, you know, a bunch of sneaker tracks, and like, you know, we like it, a little bit further down the trail, we ran into probably 3 other groups of people.
And the outfitters?
Yeah, and the outfitters, like, yeah, it would have been pretty perfect. The guys with mules were coming in. We could have just had them pack the whole thing out. And I mean, I can't. I'm not an expert in scoring bulls or anything, but it was definitely like a 300 plus inch.
Ben has also now for the past 2 days been going replaying the scenario, and every time he comes up to me, he's like, "So what I could have done?" I think in this moment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I replayed it, and I'm like, should I have drawn? And then when he spooked, tried to stop him. Like, I mean, I technically had a quartering away broadside shot for, I don't know, a quarter second. You know, and it's like, could I have, if I just yelled real quick or gave him, like, a little whatever, stopped him in that position? Maybe. I don't know. I immediately cow called and tried to stop him, and he just huffed it up this mountain. And I went chasing after him. I fell on my broadhead and cut my finger a little bit. A good motivation. Good cliffhanger.
Yep.
Good, like, yeah, they're out there. You know, I mean, this is a huge herd bull, public land, over the counter, Colorado unit, and it, you know, we had seen tons of hunters. There was probably 30 cars in the parking lot the whole week. Like, this area gets hit hard, and he was just standing on the trail. So
20 yards off the trail,
just, yeah, whatever, doing whatever he was doing, just hanging out. So, like, it was really one of those kind of perfect, you just never know. You're like, you really don't.
So, I think for me is, like, this being my first time, and I talked about it too, and I talked about it several folks, like, after this, like, I'm not dissuaded to elk hunt with archery, like, continued. You know, I've got another elk hunt coming up for a cow tag in Wyoming for rifle. I'm not dissuaded from doing any of that. I just, like, I don't think I'll roll into something as hard and heavy as I did for this trip, just because, like, it took a lot out of me, and it's just, like, whew.
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, it was a rough hunt.
It's tough to hike up something, you know, and that far and that steep at that elevation, and then, like, you know, you start hearing bugles and it's time to go. You got to go back down.
Yeah.
you know, and, like, you know, you do that a few times and it takes a lot out of you mentally. You know, I was talking to Justin, like, I feel like elk hunting has the most highs and lows out of any outdoor thing I've done, where, like, you're like, man, this is terrible. I'm all the way back here. I'm wet. There's nothing going on. And then you hear a bugle and it's on and you're like, all right. And then you try to get in and you're adrenaline is pumping and you're like, this is it. This is it. I'm finally going to do it. You know, I'm going to be part of the 8%ers club, and then quiet, you know, or whatever. Like, you blow them out, like, you know, and or you mistake. I blew out a herd in Oregon this year. I heard a bugle at like 200 yards and I started closing the distance in the morning, and then I heard another bugle at 400 yards. So I started heading towards that bugle thinking he was moving away, and it turned out to be another hunter, and I walked right up to the herd and blew him out and never saw him again, never heard him again. You know, and it's like just so many highs and lows where every day you're kind of like battling and constantly coming up with new plans, you know. And that's what Craig said the one morning. I was like, all right, so what's the plan? And he just, you know, he's eating his food and he's like, oh, we don't make the plan, the elk make the plan. I really like that.
True.
I was thinking that the whole time, you know, and I was like, the elk really do make the plan. Like, you can do whatever you want, but the elk are going to tell you what to do, where to go, and where you need to be. And it's just a matter of if you can get there.
You have a last thought?
I think that was a good last thought.
It was a good last thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it. So, yeah, my last thought, I'm definitely ready to do it again. Not quite to the extent of that. I think there's some
there's some definitely
time.
Easier elk.
Yeah, there's some there's time for me to grow and learn elk. Here in Colorado. Find easier elk. But no, it was an awesome experience overall, and I'm really glad I got to do it. I learned a lot to be my first season, but we'll see what next year brings. But I will say this. You know, make sure you're following podcast here, whatever podcast platform you're listening to, and sure that you're subscribed and listening to it. We do talk a lot about food, but I think pretty frequently you know, especially as we get into hunting season, we get out into the field and recount some of these experiences and really some good lessons learned along our way. Is you know, like we say in the title, is we're in pursuit of our food. These are important things that we've learned and very valuable for us to pass them on. Hopefully you've taken something from this episode. Maybe it motivates you to hunt elk. Maybe it says, well, I'm not quite ready yet. I'll give it another year or two and do some research and prepare. But either way, you know, we want you to be entertained and educated by what's going on in the world here.
Yeah, so, I just want to add, like, if you're, you know, somebody in the Northeast, you're a whitetail dude or, what, you know, dude-ess, or, and you're thinking about making the jump, like, just do it. Just come out here. Get an over-the-counter tag and just start learning. And, like, you know, I think the both non-resident over-the-counter tag for Colorado, I think, was, like, 680. Like, I had it in my head a long time that if you were going to hunt elk, you need to be spending $5,000, $6,000, $10,000, $15,000, and you can make this trip work for like $1,500, you know. It's not going to be, you're not going to see 500, you know, 450-inch bulls screaming all over the place, but they're there if you're willing to work for them.
Maybe sometimes. Even
right by the, yeah, sometimes.
Sometimes it's 20 yards off the trail.
Yeah, maybe that could be a good strategy, just hang out by the trail.
Well, I thank everybody for listening. Like I said, make sure you subscribe to the podcast, and then also whatever podcast platform you're listening to, punch that 5-star button. Tell us what we're doing wrong, or, you know, tell us what we're doing right. Thanks, everybody. Have a good night.